You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa. Ko Joel Tokuingawa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to the Wire Wharāpa Wednesday. I'm your host Joel and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined by producer Manny. E whai akene, come up on the show for our weekly catch-up with the Green Party. Wednesday Wire host Max spoke with MP Ricardo Menendez March about government ministers announcing they are considering banning rough sleeping in Auckland CBD, recent unemployment figures, and the government's action plan to combat meth usage. And I spoke with Professor John Morgan, the head of the School of Critical Studies and Education at the University of Auckland, about his article on Newsroom and his belief that the country is seeing a collapse of the second curriculum accord. Manny, what do you have for us today?
For this week's Get Action, I spoke to JT from Touch Compass on their petition to say yes to access, words shape worlds, and how they want to replace the words inclusion with access. And I also spoke with Jason Mika, Professor of Māori Management at the University of Auckland, about the ructions within Te Pāti Māori.
Yeah, ho whakaaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tukupatahi mai, text in on 5395. Kaua e wareware e ahina koutou, te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō, hei pakihiri rokiroki mā runga i te pai, tukutuku o irirangi pōho, me haere ki 95BFM, irakatikam. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Now let's get into the show.
Now it's time to hear from the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March.
During an interview with the Morning Report, RNZ's Morning Report, Prime Minister Christopher Luxon confirmed that orders for the homeless in Auckland CBD to move on were definitely a consideration. He later stated that Aucklanders don't feel safe going into the central city, and both central government and Auckland Council are considering how they can move homeless people out of the CBD ahead of summer. This follows previous reports that the government was considering a rough sleeping ban for central Auckland. This news comes as Stats New Zealand released their annual unemployment figures this week. The results show that national unemployment has risen to a 9-year high at 5.3%, with the New Zealand youth taking most of the damage. For our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, Wire host Max spoke to MP Ricardo Menendez March to discuss the unemployment figures released last week. They also spoke about the government's new action plan to combat methamphetamine use. But first, they discussed what the Green Party thought about the government's plan to decrease homelessness in Auckland CBD.
What is the Green Party's reaction to this potential bill and stance by the government?
It follows a really concerning move by National Party politicians who treat homeless people as if they're the problem, as opposed to treating homelessness as a problem. And they haven't acknowledged that their own government decisions, such as tightening access to emergency housing, cutting benefit increases in the medium to long term, all will lead to an increase in homelessness. And so we think the government should be focusing on addressing homelessness as opposed to treating homeless people as a problem that needs to be moved on.
Do you think that homelessness has gotten worse under this government?
We have heard from social service providers across the country that homelessness has indeed gotten worse under this government. And we have seen also the statistics that clearly show that more people are being rejected for basic assistance, such as getting into emergency housing, which leaves them with no other option but to potentially live on the streets. And that is completely unacceptable, and the government should take responsibility for their own actions and increasing homelessness instead of simply increasing it and then treating homeless people as if they're the problem.
What steps should the government take in decreasing homelessness then?
First of all, they need to reverse the changes they have made to tightening access to emergency housing. They need to adequately invest in funding public housing, which they have actually made cuts to. And they need to increase income support levels to livable incomes so that people do not face the challenges of having to choose between paying their rent or paying their bills, which puts them more at risk of becoming homeless in the first place.
Luxon said that homelessness is a complex problem. In this case specifically, would you agree with him?
All well and fine to say that it is a complex problem, but the problem here is that then he's treating homeless people as the problem. And instead of acknowledging that he has made some relatively simple decisions that have made this issue worse. And so I don't think he deserves to be able to hide behind the fact that indeed homelessness is a complex issue when he has actually made it worse. And the solution isn't to simply push people away from the CBD onto other neighborhoods as currently we're saying that it's from the plan.
Are the Green Party looking to campaign on anything regarding homelessness in next year's election?
We will, and we have for several years. We've long held the position that income levels should be set at a livable level, that we should be building enough public housing so that we can house people in the first place and invest in the public health systems that wrap around homeless people to ensure that we can address drug use and mental health issues that may arise from the stresses of living in the streets.
All right, moving on to the next topic. Last week, Stats NZ released the latest unemployment numbers. Figures revealed show that unemployment is at a 9-year high at 5.3%. Youth unemployment is up, with many looking to return to study, and 18,000 jobs have been lost over the past year. My next question is, what was the Green Party's reaction to the latest unemployment figures released by Stats NZ?
We're seeing a record high unemployment, at least for the almost decade, and this is a direct result of a government that has chosen to use job cuts as a way to deal with inflation. The government pushed through countless of job losses in the public sector, and what this shows is that now we're seeing young people unable to access jobs, entry-level jobs in particular, and they're being pushed into below the poverty line benefits. This is not the economy that we want to be building. We think the government should be focused on creating jobs instead of cutting them, and this is why we're campaigning for a Ministry of Green Work so that we can create tens of thousands of jobs in manufacturing and construction to ensure that people have the opportunities that they deserve, but also that we're building the infrastructure that we so desperately need.
You've been quite vocal that this is more than just a crisis and that the government has made decisions that have led to this situation. Would you say that the current unemployment situation is more to do with the government and their actions than it is the cost of living crisis?
Well, it is the government's actions that have caused a record high unemployment. You just got to see the thousands of jobs that have been cut in the public sector and the fact that they have actively relied when it comes to their management of inflation and increasing unemployment to lower the spending power of our communities across the board. And so this is part of the problem that the government is not just not taking responsibility for the unemployment crisis that they helped create, but now they're punching down on people who are on income support as a result of this unemployment crisis that we are facing. And when we look at the statistics, it is young people that are disproportionately affected by unemployment. And yet we are seeing a government that when they see young people applying for few jobs that are out there, and we're seeing some jobs receiving hundreds of applicants, that the government turns around and instead of creating jobs, decides to make access to benefits a lot harder.
Should we be concerned that the damage being done to young New Zealanders here is something that we can't recover from?
The concern here is that unless we fix the unemployment crisis and in the meanwhile ensure that we have benefits that allow people to live well, that the harms will compound. The longer that someone spends on poverty-level benefits, the more likely they are to develop health issues, the more likely they are to become homeless. And this is why the government, instead of punching down on beneficiaries, should acknowledge that there are simply not enough jobs available at the moment and ensure that unemployed people aren't living in poverty.
You've announced that your Green Jobs Guarantee will deliver an initial 40,000 jobs to rebuild infrastructure, restore nature, and build homes for people to live in. Can you explain this policy, specifically who for and how did you get to 40,000 jobs?
So it's a combination of jobs in the construction sector from the powering up of our public housing build program, as well as the Green Jobs for Nature program that needs to be properly resourced that will help restore our natural environments. And in places like Auckland, for example, it can help look after our urban streams, which in and of itself protect communities against floods. And we've seen the benefits of the work that has been done in places like Mangere, for example. But we think an injection of investment into those programs will help create additional jobs. And also, we think that we could be investing in our manufacturing sector so that, for example, we are able to build construction materials onshore when it comes to wood products, as opposed to exporting raw materials overseas, having those being manufactured overseas and then having to import them back again at a costlier price. So we think that there are areas of our economy that we can take a much more active role in planning for that will result in tens of thousands of jobs. And this is why we put out a green budget that demonstrates that this is absolutely possible and that we should be creating jobs rather than cutting them.
All right, moving on to the last topic. The government has gained widespread support for their new action plan to combat methamphetamine use. Specifically, the Drug Foundation has commended it for its health-focused interventions. The response included a nationwide media campaign that will launch in the next 3 months, as well as an extra $30 million over 4 years from the mental health and addiction budget that will go to frontline services focusing on the hardest hit communities. My next question is, does the Green Party agree that this is a positive move by the government?
There are areas of this plan that we can get behind, and we support the sentiment from stakeholders that have welcomed a more focused approach when it comes to health. The challenge remains, though, is that meth users continue being criminalized. And when we continue, nonetheless, having a criminal approach to drug use, we know that ultimately that gets in the way of taking a genuine health approach to reducing harm. Before becoming an MP, I worked at the front lines with people who were living in poverty and experiencing homelessness. And I saw how many of them were having issues and were experiencing the harms of meth use. The reality is that also we need to address issues like housing, issues like low incomes, that in and of itself can end up leading to people going into harmful and ongoing drug use when it comes to methamphetamines to cope with the stresses of poverty and homelessness. And this is why we need to take a system-wide approach to the meth crisis that we're experiencing, rather than, for example, exacerbating homelessness, exacerbating hardship, and then just pumping a bit of resources into issues like better access to drug rehabilitation.
Would you say then that the Green Party are not as much of a fan of a tougher approach against methamphetamine, but rather more of a focus on education, prevention and rehabilitation?
Well, we should take a tough approach when it comes to poverty, when it comes to homelessness, when it comes to housing insecurity and rent prices, all which can compound harms and lead people to a much more vulnerable state to the impacts of meth use. And the problem that we have is that unless we genuinely take an evidence-based approach to drug use, we'll continue criminalizing people who need support. And this is why we've always been supportive of campaigns that focus on health outcomes as opposed to handcuffs.
Would combating meth use be an issue that the Green Party would prioritize if they were in government right now?
We've long campaigned on taking an evidence-based approach when it comes to drug use, and this is why with subsequent elections, we have long pushed for governments of red and blue stripes to treat drug use as a health issue as opposed to a criminal issue.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March on the government's stance against homelessness in the Auckland CBD, the latest unemployment figures released by Stats New Zealand, and the government's new action plan to combat methamphetamine use.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March.
It's time to get action with Action Station Aotearoa, the segment where we chat with the people campaigning for a fairer future.
Disabilities come in myriad forms, but it is often how institutions and society engage with them that shapes the limitations they pose. For this week's Get Action, I spoke to JT from Touch Compass on their petition, Say Yes to Access, hashtag Yes to Access NZ Words Shape World, aiming to encourage a rethink of the way we conceptualise disability as a society by changing how we talk about it.
Yeah, kia ora, John Tamihiri Kimis, tukai noa. Kawhakaharai mātua, Touch Compass, switching to Channel 2, that's John or JT, and I'm the Executive Director for Touch Compass.
Awesome. Thank you very much. Here today, we've got your petition, Say Yes to Access, and the words that shape worlds.
Correct.
Can you talk to us about the petition, really?
Yeah, look, really, probably the best way to put it is to say, even though it's our petition, it's come from a community of sort of over about 4,500 across New Zealand. We started transforming Touch Compass as a disability-led arts organisation in 2021. And part of our journey was engaging with our community. What rose to the surface is people got a bit sick of feeling invited. And the word inclusion itself, if you dig into its history, if you're a word geek like me and half the team, the word itself translates to invite in to something that's been shut off. And access, interestingly, comes from a word that means to pass through or move through without barrier. So that's the genesis of it. And look, to keep it really simple, as it says in there, words shape worlds. So the words we use shape the worlds and our attitudes. And when every time we talk about inclusion, we're still gatekeepers. Somebody is still having to be invited in. I've got a really straightforward question for you. From the moment we're born, we're all part of the human race. Who says we're not? Why do we need to be invited in to our own society, right? And that this sort of language, this vernacular, has been allowed to go on for far too long. And we're a tiny little arts organisation, but we've got some smart people in the room, and we've looked at what's really important to our people, and access is by far the most important thing.
So with this petition, what are the changes that you would really like to see? Would it just be changing the words inclusion in sort of legislations and forms into access? Would there be more that you feel like should come along with that? But what's your perspective?
Well, there's probably two parts to it. So the first one is, in order to get societal change, attitudes need to shift, right? And this is a very simple, but in our opinion, a pretty important way to do it. Change the language you use and watch the mind shift that happens in yourselves. Take every document you've got. Take your role title, right? There's a lot of people out there right now with access and inclusion manager on it. What if they were just the access manager? What about instead of diversity, equity, and inclusion, we actually had diversity, equity, and access? So it's a real simple thing. Shift that mindset, number one. That's probably the most important part, right? Because to have anything sustain is that. So what we want everyone to do, and this is what our petition is give it a crack. 3rd of December, on the International Day of Persons with Disabilities, just change. Change the word inclusion for access and watch the mindset shift that happens when you stop being a gatekeeper.
It almost seems, as you're talking to me about this, that there is an element of action that's almost more associated with access in the sense of the need to accommodate and the ways that, you know, organizations sometimes don't when they're not stepping up enough.
Yeah, look, there's two ways to look at that. One is that access is hard, right? Inclusion is soft. And often it comes from that. It reads as kind and generous, but disabled people don't want generosity. They want opportunity. They want access, right? That's a really important thing. So if you want to sum it up, inclusion is margarine, right? Access is the real butter. And that's pretty much the context behind it, right? It's that difference between, you know, going and getting a really well-made barista coffee or scraping something out of the bottom of the tin. What would you prefer?
Yeah, absolutely. Could you talk to us about Touch Compass, Aotearoa, New Zealand? And
yeah, look, to TC, as we say it around our own house, Touch Compass, founded in 1997, nearly 30 years ago. Essentially on the blood, sweat, toil and tears of one very focused individual with a real experience in dance. So it started as a dance company that invited disabled people into the space. Over time, those people developed real great performance skill and it was seen and shown. So it became a disability integrated, still non-disabled led, but definitely forwarding and putting out front the skills and talents of disabled artists. Since 2021, we've just taken the next natural evolution. We've transformed ourselves from a disability-integrated arts organisation to disability-led. So we have disabled leadership at every strata of our organisation. We're one of the few in the country that do. There are more than just us. Go and jump on Arts Access Aotearoa's site, see their new Taha Hotu program, and you'll see a number of organisations that have committed to that path. But we're one of them. We're a little bit trailblazing. We're a little bit provocative. But hey, it's time for somebody to be bold, fierce, and leading in this space. And we think we're well positioned to do that.
That's a really interesting narrative for the organisation to go from sort of a you know, that place all the way through to this place of activism now as well, you know.
Yeah, well, one of the, as I said, we've, our community that we've built quite large across Aotearoa, we've listened, right? Not just heard their voices, but actually listened. And one of the things that just keeps rising to the surface is they want to hear stronger voices, right? There's a lot of placating and inviting and inspiration porn, as we say, around the disability arts space. A lot of, you know, well, look at that, isn't that lovely? Aren't they doing well? But within our group, we've actually got some exceptional people. One of the first people in the world to earn a PhD in dance studies is a wheelchair user. International award winners for dance and performance. Pacifica leaders in our group, Māori leaders, tangata whakaha Māori. So we've got a smart, very, very talented group. They're not looking for people to fawn upon. They're looking for people to recognise the remarkable aesthetic that is in disability arts performance, verbal, non-verbal, physical, non-physical, visible disabilities, non-visible disabilities. They are a really unique and powerful way to read the human body and to navigate the world. And we just want to ensure that we're in a country that that enables that.
Returning to the petition, I'd love to give you the floor, if there's anything that you feel like you really want to say on it, a bit of a pulpit.
Yeah, look, on behalf of all of us who put it together, the most important thing is we just want to see mindset shift. Start there. Start small. Change the language. If that influences policy design, brilliant. If it makes you think, whose voice is missing in this room? Who needs access to this place and space? And look, I'll preface one other thing for you. Access is not just ramps and captions, right? It's financial, it's spiritual, it's cultural, it's individual, it's collective. Access is multidimensional. Just think about how can we do a better job as a nation and as a people of ensuring that everybody has a fair and equitable shot at moving through the world and navigating it, whichever way they do. Right, I'm autistic ADHD. I navigate the world by compartmentalizing, recognizing patterns and connections, and then bringing them together over 20 odd plus years in the employment space. I've learned to navigate and mask and hide, but the way that I navigate is my way. There are ways that others need to navigate. So if we can just create a space where that's easy, and no one has to ask permission. The problem with inclusion, you see, is there's always a gatekeeper, right? You're welcome into this space on our time. Just go to any theatre show anywhere, right? This is the one I'll leave you with. Go to any theatre show anywhere and ask them, is this audio described? Is this sign language interpreted? And you'll probably get an answer like, oh, yeah, 4 p.m. on a Thursday, we have an audio-described show. So if you are from the blind and low-vision community, you can go see that show once at 4 in the afternoon on a Thursday or 2 p.m. on a Sunday. If you can't make that show, you're stuffed because every other show is not for you. Why not? Access is not just a budget line. It's a mindset. And where inclusion invites disabled people in, with our campaign, we're inviting people to reframe the way they think. Right? There's a lot of stuff going on in the world. Financial, people are struggling, kids are in trouble. There's a lot. But a lot of it sits at that root core of access. If you don't have access to what you need, to the resources that support your life, then that's not a nation I think we all want to live in.
That was JT from Touch Compass on their petition to change our language to focus on disability access over inclusion. If you want to see more about this petition or sign your name to it, you can find it at our.actionstation.org.nz/petitions/swap-inclusion-4-access-yes-to-access-nz.
That was Get Action with Action Station Aotearoa.
We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
95 BFM is throwing Border Radio in the back of their pickup truck and taking them out on the road for a spin at Studio One Vintage Guitars, Sunday, November 16. Come along and see Deputies Kirsten, Paul and Louie in the flesh with live tunes from Fables and Moongoose.
Oh, I said I would change the way I felt about it.
Border Radio live broadcast at Studio One Vintage Guitars, 7 till 9pm, Sunday, November 16. See y'all there now.
Garth, where's your hat, no play.
I don't have one, sir.
Then go on and pick a hat from Lost Property.
Oh, sir, those hats all have nits.
It's nits or melanoma, Garth.
It's a no hat, no play summer, so it's lucky 95BFM have you sorted with sweet merch for your noggins. Choose from four designs, two classic cap designs, one cord design, and a bucket hat. Pre-order yours now from twotonesmerch.co.nz.
Ah! Guys! He finally asked me out! He says he knows a spot.
It better not be ice cream at Mission Bay.
I hope it's not under the harbour bridge.
Oh no! What if you have to walk up Mount Eden?
He better not think Minnehaha is original.
Oh, thank God! It's a beer spot. I can try the new local brews.
The 95BFM Drive Show. A three-hour psychedelic playground of japes, jive and jams. 4 to 7pm every weekday only on 95BFM.
Thanks to the beer spot, your tappy place.
West Coast, choppy.
Regan, wake up.
West Coast.
Honey,
on
you're
shore.
Having those strange nightmares. Oh, no, no, it's not.
1 out of 10 on both coasts.
Oh, God. Father Damien, it's happening again.
Looking for tubular swells? It's the 95BFM Surf Report. Is the West Coast gnarly? Is the East Coast bogus? Do people even still use these words? Find out every morning on Breakfast and every afternoon on Drive. The Totally Radical Surf Report, proudly brought to you by the dudes and dudettes at Progear.
Wanna breathe the big song.
the world. Wanna bring the biggest song in 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 the world. Sleep with 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 the biggest song in the world.
That was I Hate It Here by Morgoth, and before that was Dog Show by Night Lunch. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Text in on 5395 or call us on 309-3879.
And it is odd for somebody to pay you $100 for a photo of your feet. That is not normal behaviour.
The Wire.
Recent tensions within Te Pāti Māori that exploded into the light last month have culminated in the expulsion of two, quote, rogue MPs, Mariameno Kapakingi of Te Tai Tokoro and Takuta Ferris of Te Tai Tonga. Despite this, much remains unresolved, and controversy lingers over the preceding actions, the manner in which they were communicated online, and how the expulsion was handled by the party leadership. I spoke with Jason Mika, Professor of Māori Management at the University of Auckland, to get his perspective on the expulsions.
To kick us off, we've seen really dramatic moments coming out of Te Pāti Māori and the kicking out of two MPs for allegedly breaking the constitution. I'd love to get your opinion on this, starting with the Te Pāti Māori constitution in particular.
Yeah, I guess with respect to the constitution, you know, it's not a document that I've read, but they will have rules that they adhere to within the constitution, and clearly there's been a sort of a a breakdown in terms of how those rules are applied or given effect by the two members which have been, I guess, ousted from their party. One of the things that I've been sort of thinking about since that decision was made to remove the two MPs from Te Pāti Māori is really the implications of that for the constituents that those members represent and their relationship with Te Pāti Māori. The effect of it is really just to highlight the sort of to focus on the individual representative, but there's also the party dynamic there too in terms of voters voting for a party and the representatives of that party. But in this instance, they've kind of separated out the two, you know, the person from the party in order to resolve some sort of unresolvable problem there.
Right, right. I've seen comments made that suggest that some of the regional party executives of Te Pāti Māori in Te Tai Tokoro, when Marimeno was booted, weren't necessarily as involved in that process as the constitution or te kawa of Te Pāti Māori would have intended it to. What would that mean, do you think, for that connection between party and candidate and electorate?
Yeah, I mean, there's just a whole lot of haze. You know, there's just a whole lot that's not clear, not transparent in terms of who's involved and to what extent in terms of the decisions that have been made. And I think there's a lot that we're not seeing in terms of the underlying problems and the nature of the problems and also the nature of an extent of regional representatives and committees and constituent involvement in the decisions that have been made to oust the two members. So I think there's a lot to sort of still play out there.
Yeah. All right. What, in relation to that, how do you feel people are taking it at the moment, given the way it's impacting Te Pāti Māori as a whole and potentially their electoral prospects going forward? Obviously, there might be upset from the community or questions unanswered. How do you feel?
I mean, I feel like, it's not a good situation. It's not a good situation for Te Pāti Māori, for the members, for the community, for the Māori community and for Aotearoa. Because, you know, what's really important is that we have, you know, effective, united sort of Māori representation in Parliament so that the issues of the day can be progressed and advanced and people's well-being can be advanced in that place. And at the moment, it's not really the business of the day. You know, it's really trying to resolve differences. It's really the focus at the moment. And so it is a little bit disappointing. But these are it's the nature of politics and how things can go in Parliament.
In terms of larger policy disagreements, it's not necessarily clear that there have been large ones, or at least that there hasn't been made public if there have been, between the candidates that have been pushed from the party and the party itself. It seems that a lot of this could be centering around tensions between two families, two whānau. Is that frustrating, given even the unity between these candidates, it's not able to be resolved?
I guess that's part of the haziness that we're not fully aware of. The issue seems to be aspects of behaviour, aspects of relationship that have caused some problems for the Pāti Māori leaders and members. But the specific nature of those problems, the behaviour, the differences in viewpoint, the differences in terms of what's going on, it's not really clear to us, because at the moment there's no agreement about what the problem is and what's caused it, and whether or not the, you know, the decision that's been taken is the right one for the party going forward. But that's the decision that's been made.
With a lot of these tensions playing out on social media, with Kiritamahere Waititi and also Iru Kapakingi both voicing their sides of the story, to some extent at least, on Instagram, do you feel like that is a positive thing for getting the story out there and getting their perspectives to people about what these tensions for them mean? Or do you feel like perhaps this is creating sort of undue publicity on this issue that created more problems than it solved?
Well, it's certainly one way to communicate with your constituents and about how you feel, but it's in terms of resolving, you know, what's gone on, you know, social media is probably not the right place to resolve disagreements. So ultimately it's going to have to come down to, and it probably has come down to discussions, kōrero, wānanga, to try to resolve things. But social media is the sort of the way that we conduct business these days. Yeah.
Yeah. I'd love to give you the floor here now if there's anything you want to talk about in particular in relation to this.
I think really between now and the next election is, you know, there's a lot to be, you know, to unfold in terms of, I guess, where the Party Māori is at, what's going to happen with the two now independent Māori MPs, what their next moves might be in terms of how do they continue to represent their constituents, and what are their aspirations in terms of remaining potentially in Parliament as independents or in some other form. So all of those sorts of things need to be, will play up, and we'll all be watching with interest, I'm sure.
Do you have any idea now how you feel about that? Do you feel like they should be continuing to stay on in Parliament? Should they be forming a new party like the Mana Movement? Or do you feel like it's something that's more of a wait and see, and they'll do what feels right for them?
Yeah, the two members, Tākuta and Maramino, they were elected by their constituents from their regions as representatives of the Māori Party, and now they've got to, I guess, reaffirm their constituents, whether or not, you know, as independents or in some other form, like another political party or some other form of alliance, is the best way for them to continue to represent those people who put them there.
Thank you very, very much, Jason. It was awesome to have you on.
Yep, kia ora.
Kia ora.
That was Jason Meeker, Professor of Māori Management at the University of Auckland, on the impact of the expulsion of two MPs from Te Pāti Māori. We'll be right back after a short break. The Wire.
crosses. It'll happen.
That was R.L. Stine by They Are Gutting a Body of Water. And before that was Faith of Crisis by Twine. Welcome back to The Wire.
The government has indicated a progress.
The Wire.
In an article on Newsroom, John Morgan, head of the School of Critical Studies and Education at the University of Auckland, discusses his belief that we are seeing a collapse in the country's curriculum accord. This comes as the government has announced a plethora of changes to the country's curriculum heading forward. I spoke to Morgan about the history of the curriculum accords in the country and why we are seeing changes in this space. Firstly, for those unaware, what is a curriculum accord and how did this term come about?
So a curriculum accord was termed by the American educationalist Michael Apple in an essay he wrote in 1988. Curriculum accords are periods of, for Apple, are periods when there is broad agreement about the aims and purposes of schooling and what should be in the curriculum. So it's almost when sort of society agrees that this is what most kids will be taught, and although there are some arguments about whether we should have a bit more sort of modern history or whether we should teach more ancient history or different forms of mathematics, there's broad agreement that teachers and educators should be left to decide the content of the curriculum. So they're moments of stability. That's the curriculum accord. And in my article where you're going to ask me this question, I guess, I suggest that when those accords break down, we get what we might call a crisis of the curriculum, and there's intense debate about what happens, what should be taught in schools.
Have we seen a sort of crisis, as you just mentioned, with our curriculum accords in the past before? You've mentioned in the article there were at least two different curriculum accords we've seen. Was there a breakdown between the transition between the two of these? Those?
Part of Apple's argument, and the argument I make in my article, is that curriculum accords tend to happen when there is broad economic growth, there is some sort of form of social stability, people broadly agree what culture means. So at those moments when those things break down, the curriculum becomes almost like a sort of a proxy for that type of debate as to what's going wrong in our society. So I argue that in the post-war period from 1939 onwards to the mid-1970s, New Zealand is characterized by a broad curriculum accord where there's agreement about what schools are for and what should be taught in schools. It was very much a British model. It was imported from Britain, but there was a strong American influence, and there was quite an argument about whether we should be pursuing a more traditional curriculum or a more progressive one. But from the 1970s, the agreement about the aims and purposes of education begins to break down. So there's much more sort of worry about, are we meeting the needs of a diverse changing population? Are we meeting the needs of a more affluent youth culture who are becoming teenagers and sort of going their own way? The world of work is changing, and are we preparing the children in the right way through the curriculum? And so in those periods of intense debate in the 1970s and early 1980s, the curriculum became almost like a political football. And that's sort of the last crisis of curriculum.
You say in your piece on Newsroom that the second curriculum accord seems to be collapsing. What are we seeing now that has made you come to this conclusion?
I think that what's happened from around 1990 to perhaps 2020, 2021, a gradual agreement about the aims and purposes of educational policy was established, and a new curriculum accord. This was the idea that New Zealand curriculum ought to be producing young people who were entrepreneurial, innovative. They were able to learn how to learn. They could be independent and flexible, and in order to take sort of their place in a competitive labour market, and that would benefit New Zealand, which is a small Pacific nation, having to compete in a competitive global world. So the economy became much more sort of central to educational debate, and we saw that very much in sort of what some people call the neoliberal experiment, where there was very much a sense of giving schools some ownership, increasing some flexibility, choices of subjects. Subject knowledge, detailed knowledge, became less important than the skills of learning how to learn. And over that period from 1990 to about 2020, more and more educators and teachers took on board those ideas. So we had arguments about flexible learning environments, modern learning environments. We had ideas about personalization of the curriculum. We had ideas about formative assessment rather than end-of-year tests. So we had a sort of what I call a progressive alliance. And The highlight of this, and I suppose the other thing to add to that, was there was an increasing recognition that although schooling was creating divides and inequality of outcomes, the aim of education policy ought to be more inclusive and ought to recognise the evolving bicultural nature of Aotearoa New Zealand. So we had much more recognition of Te Tiriti, and that was expressed, the high point of that for me is expressed in the 2023 curriculum refresh, which was very much a strongly moral curriculum, which said this is how we think schools should be producing people to be part of this new bicultural nation. And that was the high point of it. That curriculum accord, I think, has begun to break down in the period of the Stanford Ministry of Education and the National First Coalition Government. They've really tried to dismantle much of that architecture, which has become common sense over the previous 20 to 30 years. And that's why it's become so noisy and so conflicting, because many of those common sense assumptions about what schools were for and what teachers were doing are now being directly challenged by the government. Now, I suppose the question you would have to ask is this related to a crisis of the nation? Just like in the 1970s, was it something happening in the economy which was changing, something that was happening in the wider culture? And that's something I leave untouched in my article, because my hunch is that something is going on. The economy post-2008 has been has not rebounded to levels of economic growth of the previous 20 years. There seems to be a much more sort of fractious public youth culture around social media. There seem to be all sorts of debates about parenting and how we should be living our lives. And all of these things are impinging on the question of what schools are for. So I'm sort of arguing that the curriculum accord of the 1990s to 2020 is coming to an abrupt end, and we have to reimagine what curriculum might be in the future.
And that kind of leads on to my next question, which is sort of a million-dollar question, but what can we expect heading forward?
Well, I think in a moment we have a strong, what I would call a conservative restoration, which is not just happening in New Zealand, it's happening in the United States, it's happening in Britain, where there's been a return to sort of arguments for what some people call a knowledge-rich curriculum, which is often interpreted as being going back to basics, going back to traditional subjects, making sure we teach lists of rivers and lists of countries in geography, lists of the traditional history curriculum. So we're seeing a sort of a backlash towards a sort of form of conservatism with a small c. I wonder whether that will last for very long. I think that the new curriculum accord will probably have to take into account the fact of a change in climate, the fact that our post-crisis economies are likely to be smaller and we're going to have to sort of do more with less. We're probably going to see a lot of division taking place in society, and we're going to sort of see new ways of cooperating and new ways of schooling come into the fore. So, you know, you might, for instance, argue, and some of my students argue with me, that the rise of homeschooling and free schooling in New Zealand is a reflection that people are sort of giving up on some of the formal institutions and finding some other ways to live. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not, but it's an interesting one question to ponder. It might be that the new curriculum will be more on making and doing rather than on cognitive development. I mean, all of those questions are open. It comes back to Apple's argument that the curriculum is strongly influenced by the wider economy, society and culture. And so as those three things change, it's likely that what we count as valid knowledge will change.
That was the University of Auckland's John Morgan on the collapse of the country's curriculum accord.
Children eat worms and bugs and all sorts of things when they crawl in around.
The Wire. That was The Wire.
Kuira te ho taka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I korero mai ki o mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Wednesday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today, the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March, Touch Compass's JT, and the University of Auckland's Jason Mika and John Morgan. Nei rā hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakaronga ana. Thank you for tuning in to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Bridge. Have a great day and keep it on the B.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.